were under huge pressure. By 2015, of all the European banks that had once challenged for top rankings on Wall Street, only Deutsche Bank was still competing for a top spot in global investment banking, and that was widely seen as a sign of its desperation. Deutsche had no other secure business line to fall back on. The traffic, on the whole, was from the United States to Europe. All the big American banks still maintained a major presence in London, but it was a sign of the times that in 2014, Wall Street was for the first time ranked above the city as a global banking location in ZEN Group's widely watched report. How could London regain its edge? In the wake of the crisis, the major competitors of America's global banks were not European, but Asian. The British bank that had done best after the crisis was HSBC. Driven by competitive pressure, London embarked on a remarkable 21st century gamble. As it had done for the United States, the City of London would remake itself as China's financial gateway to the world. Sidestepping the geopolitics of Sino-American competition, a special relationship to China would restore London's competitive edge. In the spring of 2012, the City of London Corporation initiated a project to make the city into a key center for renminbi trading. The result was a series of spectacular firsts. Already in 2012, HSBC had issued the first RMB-denominated bond, and London claimed 62% of all RMB payments business outside China. In June 2013, to backstop the expanding RMB business, the Bank of England entered into a swap arrangement with the PBOC. Beijing conferred on London-based asset managers the privilege of being the first Western firms to be allowed to invest directly in RMB-denominated shares. In October 2014, the UK Treasury itself issued a 3 billion RMB bond. The United States had long borrowed from China. Now the UK would borrow in the Chinese currency. In making these moves, the Bank of England explicitly cited the model of the euro-dollar markets of the 1970s. The difference, of course, was that in facilitating the emergence of the euro-dollar market, London had enabled global finance to escape government regulation. By contrast, in facilitating the internationalization of the renminbi, the City of London and the UK government were working hand in glove with the authorities in Beijing. London insisted on normalizing this relationship. China was a crucial emerging market. Liberalization would follow internationalization. What this turned a blind eye to was the fact that both the United States and China were playing for geo-economic position. China's proposal for the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank brought this out into the open. Washington's furious reaction to London's eagerness to join the Chinese-led bank was telling. The boldness of London's move becomes even more remarkable when we consider the wider field it had to be situated in. In the 1980s, Britain had positioned itself similarly as an entrepôt for Japanese investment by both Japanese banks and manufacturers. Britain as a gateway for global FDI was a voice for market liberalization inside the EU. In the 21st century, playing off the Americans and the Chinese in financial services might be thought of as analogous to Germany's position as a global exporter of high-tech manufacturers. On his visit to Beijing in 2013, this seemed to be Cameron's vision. He offered Britain as a partner uniquely placed to make the case for deepening the EU's trade and investment relationship with China, and held out the vision of an ambitious and comprehensive EU-China free trade agreement. But that made the question all the more pressing. How secure was the UK's place in the EU? The 2008 crisis marked a break in Britain's relations with the EU. As the UK economy went into recession, the popular mood toward Europe soured. Nor did the Tories, in opposition, do anything to dampen that resentment. The huge surge in Eastern European migration, welcomed by the Blair and Brown governments, made an excellent stick to beat Labour with. Once the Tory-led coalition began to force through its austerity agenda, the strain that immigration allegedly imposed on the NHS and social services provided a lightning rod. Britain's lopsided growth added further to the sense of frustration. Whereas the production sectors of the UK economy, manufacturing, construction, etc., stagnated, Between 2010 and 2014, financial services surged ahead by 12.4%. Driven by the wealth of the city, in London and its environs, house prices rocketed by 50% between 2013 and 2016, spectacularly outstripping growth in the rest of the country. London was the cosmopolitan global city par excellence, the preferred home of oligarchs. In economic terms, rebalancing was a myth. In political terms, it was not. Across much of the UK, London's cosmopolitan affluence aroused a deep antipathy. For conservative commentators friendly to UKIP, London has become shorthand for faraway people with no grasp of the nation's problems. London was one capital of this elite, Brussels another. The populist tabloid Daily Express began campaigning for Brexit in November 2010 and became the first newspaper to ally itself with UKIP. In October 2011, as the Eurozone crisis reached its height, 80 Tory backbench MPs broke with the government, demanding a referendum on the Lisbon Treaty and further EU constitutional change. Polls in the fall of 2011 showed barely one-third of the British electorate approving of continued EU membership, with over 50% against. If the modernizing big business wing of the Tory party wanted to maintain its grip, it clearly needed to resolve the European issue once and for all. And the pressure came from two sides, from outside as well as inside Britain. The reaction to the crisis, visible in Europe, was ominous for London. As usual, the French were the enemy. Sarkozy and Trichet seemed bent on displacing the city of London, which they regarded as a source of financial instability, from the centre of euro-denominated finance. With the governments of Europe struggling to contain the eurozone crisis, it could not help but seem anomalous that most trading in euros and most transactions in euro-denominated derivatives took place in London. Many member states liked the idea of a financial transactions tax. From the opposition benches, both the French socialists and the German SPD were pushing the idea. Given the political weakness of her coalition partners, Merkel could not afford to ignore them. A study by the Commission came to the inevitable conclusion that any such tax would generate 62% or more of its revenue in the City of London. It was these tensions that unloaded in December 2011 in the disastrous clash between the UK and the rest of the EU over the fiscal compact. Tellingly, Cameron came to the do-or-die Eurozone talks in Brussels with one key agenda item: to protect the City of London. The plans being touted by Van Rompuy for deep integration up to and including Eurobonds were unacceptable to both Berlin and London, so Cameron believed that he had the basis for a deal. In exchange for his support in blocking the federalist agenda, Merkel would promise Cameron to exempt the city from any onerous regulations. That proved to be a misunderstanding. To navigate the Eurozone crisis, Merkel needed Sarkozy and the SPD in the Bundestag far more than she needed Cameron. Feeling betrayed, Cameron vetoed the deal, leaving him looking like a narrow-minded lobbyist for the City of London. Meanwhile, Merkel and Sarkozy's grand fiscal compact was reduced to an intergovernmental bargain. The clash was appallingly badly handled by Cameron, but it was not without logic. To get a grip on the Eurozone crisis, Berlin and Paris clearly did need to move toward deeper fiscal and financial integration. At every meeting of the European Council, at the G20, at the G8, in public and in private, the British government urged this logic on the Eurozone. To Anglophone economists, the functional necessity was simply inescapable. Draghi's "whatever it takes" came as a profound relief. But though Eurozone consolidation was a necessity for the leaders of the Tory party, it had serious political implications. The banking union and a fiscal union were unacceptable to a broad swath of opinion in Britain, not just the Europhobes. If deeper Eurozone integration was a matter not of whether, but of when, London would have to force Brussels to openly embrace the model of a multi-speed and multi-tiered Europe. It is easy to forget in retrospect, but the Brexit referendum was not conceived as an in-out choice on UK membership in the EU as is, nor was it merely a means to extract minor concessions. London operated from the hubristic assumption that Britain could change the EU's course. While the Euro countries continued on their path toward deeper integration, Britain would force Brussels to formally recognise not just a multi-speed, but a multi-directional model. The UK was not heading more slowly to ever closer union. If the Tories had their way, it was not heading there at all. Brussels needed to be brought to accept that fact, as well as its implications for the political economy of Europe. The offshore status of the City of London as an inside-outside financial hub had to be permanently recognised. Not only was this confrontation inescapable, but now was the moment for London to force the issue. To move forward from the crisis of 2010 to 2012, to consolidate the institutional structures of the Eurozone, its members would have to face the difficult business of treaty change. Those complex negotiations would have to start in 2013, once the Eurozone had stabilised. They would culminate in 2016 at the latest. It was during those delicate negotiations that Britain would have maximum leverage. The Eurozone's agonising efforts at consolidation would open the window of strategic opportunity for Cameron to negotiate a new dispensation. It was this triple calculation, the effort by the metropolitan leadership of the Tory party to assert control over its party base, the hubristic assumption that London had enough clout to force the structural questions on the EU, and the judgment that now was the time to do it, that culminated in Cameron's fateful speech at the new headquarters of the Bloomberg News Corporation in the City of London on January 23, 2013. It was not an overtly anti-European speech, but Cameron insisted on the need to redefine the purpose of the EU beyond the Eurozone. He had promised that he would curb immigration to the UK. To do so, he wanted to limit the rights of EU citizens to claim benefits in the UK. He wanted safeguards for the non-Eurozone members of the EU against further decisions on integration by the Eurogroup core. He wanted, at least as far as the UK was concerned, to draw a line under the basic European promise of ever closer union. He called for negotiations, and on that basis promised that there would be a referendum by 2017 at the latest. It was a coherent strategy, but a risky one. As spring turned to summer in 2013, it became obvious that the British were over-optimistic in imagining that the Eurozone would move from the crisis of 2010 to 2012 to full-scale renegotiation of the treaties. That might make sense from the point of view of economic governance, but Berlin, Paris, and Brussels understood all too well how vulnerable treaty talks would make them. After the shocking result delivered by the May 2014 European elections, treaty renegotiation was postponed for the foreseeable future. Cameron's window of opportunity never opened. The idea of a grand bargain between Britain, the Dutch, and the Germans to negotiate a new, liberal vision of the common market was stillborn. In the summer of 2014, the choice of Juncker as the new Commission president, in the face of a bitter campaign of British opposition, was a sign that London's leverage was dwindling fast. In 2014 to 2015, Europe was struck by the Ukraine crisis, the struggle over Greece, and the refugee crisis, all of which made the EU look bad, the UK look grossly uncooperative, and Cameron's reform agenda look trivial. Cameron spoke grandly of his new vision of the European future. But didn't it all come down to irresponsible, xenophobic pandering and the selfish interests of the City of London? But Cameron could not pull back, all the less when in May 2015 the Tories unexpectedly won an outright majority. The countdown to the promised referendum was ticking. Even without treaty talks, could Cameron negotiate any significant concessions from Brussels? Berlin wanted to help. Merkel was keen to avoid the lurching upset to the balance of power in Europe that would result from Brexit. But after the December 2011 debacle and London's tasteless campaign against Juncker, Britain's brand was toxic. Even the nationalists in Warsaw were hard to win over to the demand to limit the freedom of movement. It was, after all, directed against Poles. There wasn't very much that Tusk, as president of the European Council, could offer Cameron. The EU couldn't allow the UK to dictate the future course of integration. Freedom of movement and the equal treatment of EU citizens were non-negotiable. Desperate to be able to present the British voters with some sort of deal, on February 20, 2016, Cameron settled for an emergency break that would allow the UK to limit benefit payments to migrants for a one-off 7-year period. In addition, Tusk agreed that the EU should recognise that the United Kingdom is not committed to further political integration in the European Union. References to ever closer union do not apply to the United Kingdom. As one experienced British member of the European Parliament commented, left as they are, the words mean little of substance. Indeed, nothing might change. All treaty articles could just continue to apply to the UK. It would be up to London to assert itself. It was a far cry from Cameron's promise of January 2013 that Britain could initiate a fundamental rethink of the EU's purpose. It was much less than the British Prime Minister needed to hold the Tory party together. Immediately, two Tory heavyweights, Mayor of London Boris Johnson and Education Minister Michael Gove, broke away to launch the mainstream Tory wing of the Brexit campaign in the referendum that was now set for June 23, 2016. When confronting Syriza the year before, German Finance Minister Schäuble had declared that as far as he was concerned, elections could not be allowed to interfere with the fundamentals of economic policy. Greece's economy accounted for 1% of the EU's GDP. In the Brexit referendum, a simple majority would decide over the future of a country whose economy accounted for 17% of the whole. For the UK, the stakes were enormous. Half of Britain's trade, or around $200 billion, went to the EU. Of Britain's stock of $1.2 trillion in FDI, half was from the EU. Both European and non-European investors favoured Britain because of its membership in the Union. The Japanese car industry had made the UK into its main base for exports to the rest of Europe. By 2015, 3.2 million EU citizens were living in the UK, of whom 2.3 million had jobs, 7% of the workforce. 1.2 million UK citizens lived permanently in the EU. Of course, trade, investment, and migration would have happened between the UK and Europe, whether or not the UK was a member of the EU. But how much? According to the best guesses of the economists, trade with other EU members was 55% greater than one would have expected without EU membership. For the city, the questions were even more acute. Tens of thousands of jobs and billions of pounds in business depended on the so-called passporting arrangements, which allowed banks in London to operate as though they were inside the Eurozone. It was a convenient fiction for European, British, American, and Asian financial firms. It was not a concession that London could hope to maintain if it was no longer even a member of the EU. Popular support for the EU was uncertain. Brussels was a red rag to the nationalist right. The bankers and the London elite were unpopular. The answer of the Remain campaign was to double down. It set up its base camp in the city. Its strategy was never to win voters to the EU. The EU, the strategists decided, was unsellable. Europe's politicians were asked not to make appearances in Britain. They would only make matters worse. Headed by the top PR team of the Conservative Party, backed up by Liberals and Labour, the Remain campaign had one message. British voters will never love the European Union, but maybe they can be terrified into voting not to leave it. It was a strategy aptly dubbed Project Fear, a term first coined in the context of the Scottish independence referendum in 2014. Its architects were the Australian PR guru Lynton Crosby and Jim Messina, who had been hired from Obama's White House. Messina made clear what he thought the stakes were. Given these challenging economic times, the very last thing we should do is risk the UK and EU economies with this risky Brexit move. What Messina and his cohorts meant by the economy was business. So their campaign set itself to winning a popular majority for the simple and unapologetic proposition that if the EU was good for UK business, then Remain was good for Britain. 50 of Britain's leading firms were persuaded to sign a statement that Britain will be stronger, safer, and better off in a reformed EU. Behind the scenes, there was an effort by the Confederation of British Industry to persuade its leading members to put warnings about Brexit in their annual reports. The City of London Corporation overrode objections from Brexit voices to openly support Remain. Some business leaders worried, somewhat squeamishly, that to spell out the job losses and the cancellation of investment projects that would likely follow on Brexit might have the air of blackmail. At least as far as the trade unions were concerned, they need not have worried. Labour MP Pat McFadden, a former government minister and co-chair of the Labour Party's Remain campaign, insisted, "I think business has a legitimate voice in the debate, and if they want to make their views known, they have every right to do so." Unite, Britain's biggest trade union and principal donor to the Labour Party, with around 500,000 members, sent a clear message. "The message to our members in BMW, Airbus, etc. is very straightforward. It's jobs, rights, remain." The same message was echoed from around the world. On April 12th, the IMF announced that severe regional and global damage might follow if Britain voted to leave. According to the IMF, the mere fact of holding the referendum was so damaging to investor confidence that the fund was forced to lower its forecast for UK growth by 15%, from 2.2 to 1.9%. The consequences of an actual Brexit, Lagarde warned, ranged from pretty bad to very, very bad. The G7 meeting in Tokyo let it be known that a UK exit from the EU would reverse the trend towards greater global trade and investment and the jobs they create, and is a further serious risk to growth. As Angela Merkel put it, the G7 intended to send the signal that all who sat here want Britain to stay part of the EU. Back in Britain, the UK Treasury came out with a lengthy report claiming that the damage would be between £2,600 and £5,200 per annum per household. By 2030, GDP might be lower by as much as 6%, costing the government between £20 billion and £45 billion in tax revenue, doing severe damage to public services or forcing a substantial increase in tax rates. The Remain campaign was the legendary Clinton-era slogan, "It's the economy, stupid," transposed in the most literal and massive form. It echoed the determinism of Thatcher and Merkel's "there is no alternative." The total alignment of interests and expertise that it presented could not but appear uncanny. Characteristically, Chancellor Osborne gave voice to the unease that many felt, but most did not openly express. The total unanimity of authoritative opinion behind Remain, he told journalists, was not a conspiracy. It's called a consensus. The economic argument is beyond doubt. It was never, however, quite as monolithic as the Remain campaign would have liked. Given that the outcome was uncertain, and a large part of the population clearly preferred Brexit, there were risks for companies identifying too openly with Remain. The City of London was not unanimous. A libertarian wing was attracted to the idea of breaking with Brussels. All the more telling was the stance of the major foreign investors in the city. The loudest of all and the most committed to the Remain cause were America's investment banks. Given their role in the City of London, they had a huge stake in Britain's position in the EU, and they were not afraid to say so. London was their gateway to the European economy and to Eurozone business. As economists from Goldman Sachs pointed out, BIS statistics showed that US banks held $424 billion in claims, assets, on UK borrowers at the end of 2015, including $46 billion in loans to UK banks. Derivatives, guarantees, and credit commitments brought the total to $919 billion. UK bank exposure to the United States was even larger, at $1.4 trillion of financial claims. Given these investments, it was hardly surprising that Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, and Morgan Stanley all made substantial and early donations to the Remain campaign. Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan campaigned openly alongside Osborne in favour of Remain. That the United States was not indifferent to Britain's position in Europe was the message that President Obama came to London to deliver in person On April 22, 2016, he made his visit at Cameron's personal request. Obama was hugely popular with the UK public, and he did not hold back. In the BBC's words, the American president delivered a full-on, no-holds-barred effort to persuade Britain to stay in the EU. The special relationship, World War II, and the challenges of the present all demanded that the UK remain an integral part of Europe. Obama understood that it might be sensitive for an outsider to address Britain at such a delicate moment, but I will say, with the candour of a friend, that the outcome of your decision is a matter of deep interest to the United States. Furthermore, the British public needed to know that the Brexit campaign's hope that it would be able rapidly to strike a new trade treaty between an independent Britain and the United States was based on false premises. America's focus in trade negotiations was on the big blocs. The Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership between the United States and the EU, the Atlantic counterpart to the TPP in Asia, was the key to the future. Maybe some point down the line there might be a UK-US trade agreement, but it's not going to happen any time soon. The UK is going to be in the back of the queue. American power and money were clearly signalling where it wanted Britain to line up. The extension of Wall Street to Europe by way of the City of London, which had defined international finance since the 1970s, was on the line. Little wonder that the leading intellectual journal of the left put the choice as follows. A vote to remain, whatever its motivation, will function in this context as a vote for a British establishment that has long channeled Washington's demands into the Brussels negotiating chambers, scotching hopes for a social Europe since the Single European Act of 1986. The monolithic focus of the Remain campaign aimed not only to own the economy, own business, and own the fact that you'll be better off by voting to stay. In so doing, they set out to draw a line between reasonable and unreasonable politics. Without economic arguments, the Brexiteers would be driven onto more marginal terrain, above all, immigration and isolating Britain from the world. This, the Remain team hoped, would bring the more eccentric and troubling elements of the Brexit camp to the fore, notably Nigel Farage and the UKIP. Their inflammatory rhetoric would drive away undecided middle-of-the-road voters. As a tactic, it had the intended effect. The Brexit campaign did indeed bring immigration to the fore. What the Remainers underestimated was the risk they were running. They did not appreciate that along with the desire to put two fingers up to the establishment, immigration and xenophobia were, in fact, winning cards. The racial politics did not stop even at the person of the President of the United States. What right, Boris Johnson demanded to know, did Obama have to suggest to Britain concessions of sovereignty that the United States would never accept? Why should Britain trust a president who had removed the bust of Churchill from the Oval Office? Some said it was a snub to Britain. Some said it was a symbol of the part Kenyan president's ancestral dislike of the British Empire, of which Churchill had been such a fervent defender. Some said that perhaps Churchill was seen as less important than he once was. Perhaps his ideas were old-fashioned and out of date. Johnson's artfully placed dog whistle about the part Kenyan president did the job. Johnson whistled and Farage came. Where Johnson prevaricated, Farage's racist growl was unambiguous. As far as the leader of the UKIP was concerned, it was obvious that Obama, because of his grandfather and Kenya and colonialization, bears a grudge against this country. In May, as the Brexit campaign gathered pace, it was immigration that came ever more to the fore. Cameron himself had given hostages to fortune. 5 years earlier, he had promised that the figure would be cut to tens of thousands. In late May 2016, the Office for National Statistics reported that net migration in the previous year had, in fact, reached 333,000, the second highest figure on record. On June 16th, the Farage wing of the Brexit campaign unveiled its most dramatic poster. Entitled Breaking Point, it featured a bedraggled column of Syrian refugees marching toward what was, in fact, the Slovenian border. It had little to do with Brexit as such, but it gave new meaning to the slogan of taking back control. European disorder was what Britain must be defended against. Later that same day, a crazed neo-Nazi advocate of Brexit murdered the popular Remain MP Joe Cox in broad daylight. Remain's Project Fear had met its match. Referendum Day began, with Remain in a relatively confident mood. By the early hours of June 24th, it was clear that Brexit had won a narrow victory. In retrospect, the polls had been indicating the likely outcome for some time. Brexit won in the same areas that the UKIP had triumphed in 2014, and it won with the same kind of people. Core Tory voters, the elderly provincial middle class, voted en masse for Brexit. They probably always would have. But they were joined by a large cohort of lower-income, less well-educated voters who had been drifting to the right since the 1990s. According to one polling group, 60% of people in the upper, middle, and middle-class socio-economic groups, those in professional and managerial jobs, backed Britain's EU membership, whereas among the unemployed and unskilled workers, the percentage was reversed. 60% of Labour voters turned out for Remain, but that went only to show that in much of the country, the Labour Party was largely divorced from poorer and less well-educated voters. Apart from education, the other socio-economic variable that weighed heavily in the balance was the pain inflicted by austerity since 2010, and that hurt worst, where decline was a long-term phenomenon. But even more than low education and low income, Brexit voting was correlated with authoritarianism. On the kind of cultural maps drawn by marketing experts, Brexit voting sat in close proximity to values like security, support for the death penalty, and a preference for the public flogging of sex offenders. A Brexit vote, whatever its motivation, added fuel to the nationalist fire. What is far less clear is that a Brexit vote was a vote against globalization. That was the assumption of commentators around the world, and it was a reasonable thing to imagine on the basis of a conventional understanding of Brexit's likely impact. But it was to misunderstand the mindset of the Brexiteers. They, in fact, imagined that leaving Europe was a way to restore Britain's greatness and freedom. As a nationalist vote against Europe, Brexit was not a vote for Britain to play a smaller role in the world. Rather, on the contrary, it was a demand that Britain should play a role in the world independent of Europe, not submerged within it. As Tory Party Home Secretary and future Prime Minister Theresa May would put it, what Britain had voted for on June 23rd was to leave the European Union and embrace the world. It was the moment we chose to build a truly global Britain. Brexit was a vote for autonomy. Or to put it less politely, and more truly in the spirit of the vote, it was a vote for national adventurism. And an adventure is certainly what the UK got. As the referendum result was announced, sterling suffered its biggest one-day loss in history. There was a brief moment of panic in real estate investment funds. Would a collapsing pound unravel international investments in London? On Friday, June 24th, global stock markets saw $2 trillion wiped off share values. By the following Monday, losses had risen to $3 trillion. Whereas investors had been expecting interest rates to keep edging up, as the Fed moved away from quantitative easing and were thus rebalancing their portfolios away from fixed income bonds, funds now flooded into safe assets like treasuries, driving yields down. Was this a prelude to another 2008? Diagnosing the economic data was itself a political issue. Remain had predicted that Brexit would be a disaster. They had laid out an apocalyptic scenario, and in the aftermath, Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, stuck to the script. The economy was suffering, he told journalists in July, from economic post-traumatic stress disorder amongst households and businesses, as well as in financial markets. The swap lines were readied for reactivation. Despite sterling's plunge, there would be no shortage of dollar liquidity. On August 4th, Carney ramrodded an emergency stimulus package of bond buying through the Bank of England board. Viewed from the bleak perspective of a defeated advocate of Remain, this made perfect sense. Carney was doing his best to forestall the worst. But it was the advocates of Brexit who now set the terms, and Carney's actions infuriated them. For the Bank of England to be activating swap lines and lurching into another round of QE was to signal a crisis, of which the most die-hard Brexiteers denied the reality. In their view, far from calming the markets, the Bank of England's overreaction was feeding uncertainty, inducing the panic that Remain had predicted, but which had failed to arrive. For Ashoka Modi, a non-conformist ex-IMF economist who had seen the Irish crisis in 2010 close up, the drill was all too familiar. Though Carney's instruments were different, implementing QE rather than refusing it, it was a strategy of tension like that pursued by the ECB during the Eurozone crisis. If the Bank of England kept its cool, allowing the pound to slide and the British economy to rebalance, there was no reason to expect a crisis. Ruth Lee, a pro-Brexit economist, declared, "The BOE's package on August 4th was premature, and may well turn out to be, if not unnecessary, actually counterproductive. I'd have much preferred if he had kept quiet and just waited until he had some hard data." Once the initial shock had worn off, far from collapsing, consumer demand surged on a wave of cheap credit as households sought to get ahead of whatever price increases might be coming their way. The handful of economists who had supported Brexit demanded that their Remain colleagues apologize for misleading the public about the likely fallout. It was true. There had been no implosion, but there had not been any Brexit either. Brexit, it turned out, was a process, not a single moment of decision. It was an unfathomably complex and protracted process. The Brexiteers had promised freedom and control. They had promised regime change, and as Adam Posen, president of the influential think tank, the Peterson Institute in D.C., and formerly of the Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee, put it, "Regime changes are not neutral. Constitutions reflect the interests of those dominant at the time." But who was dominant in post-Brexit Britain? That, precisely, was the question. It is hard to think of any moment in Britain's recent history in which the locus of power was less obvious than in the aftermath of Brexit. The Remain coalition had included the leadership of both main political parties and what most people think of as the establishment. They lost a crucial referendum by a slender margin and surrendered authority to their opponents, who revealed themselves to be utterly unprepared for their own victory. How often had the left fantasized about such a moment of disempowerment? But this was no new dawn. After a few weeks of chaos in the Conservative camp, Theresa May emerged as the new Prime Minister. It was a logical fit. May had made her reputation as a stern Home Secretary, pushing a protective agenda of immigration restriction. Though she had cautiously campaigned for Remain, she was well suited to represent the insular majority. And she put a brave face on things. The population had voted for Brexit, and that is what she would deliver. For the City of London and British big business, the vote was a breathtaking shock. And for some commentators, it was precisely this body blow that offered the prospect of a grand rebalancing. Was this a moment at which the structures of power and money that had consolidated around the City of London since the 1970s might be cracked open? Modi hailed the result because it shattered the nexus between an ever larger financial sector and a strong pound. The only people who truly lose from the pound's depreciation are those who borrowed short-term dollars to invest in long-term property assets. This elite group continues to hold the microphones of policymaking, and its words reverberate through the financial press. London's wealth had long crowded out the rest of the British economy. Perhaps now, with a devalued pound, UK manufacturing might recover its competitiveness. In fact, of course, Britain's largest manufacturing exporters had thrown their weight solidly behind the Remain campaign, and with good reason. Given the ferocity of global competition, the last thing they needed was years of uncertainty about market access. Industries like the large motor vehicle industry were foreign-owned, mainly German and Japanese. Those investors might well see Brexit as a signal to withdraw. The devaluation benefited them only marginally because most exports from the UK have low price elasticity, and the gains in competitiveness were substantially offset by the increase in the cost of imported materials. That the status quo had suffered a blow was undeniable. Whether it would give way to something better balanced and more prosperous in the foreseeable future was a different question. The groundswell of anti-EU sentiment had been building for decades, but it was a politics of resentment and protest. It had not formulated a positive alternative vision. Now May and her personal advisers had to come up with an agenda. To the astonishment of many, it seemed that they were determined to carry out a radical pivot. Overnight, they would replace David Cameron's agenda of upper-class modernization with national welfarism with an admixture of soft authoritarianism. As May put it in a defining speech to the Tory Party conference in October 2016, "Today, too many people in positions of power behave as though they have more in common with international elites than with the people down the road. But if you believe you are a citizen of the world, you are a citizen of nowhere. You don't understand what citizenship means." Skipping over the Tory Party's own policies since 2010, May returned to the crisis of 2008. It wasn't the wealthy who made the biggest sacrifices after the financial crash, but ordinary, working-class families. "And if you're one of those people who lost their job, who stayed in work but on reduced hours, took a pay cut as household bills rocketed, or someone who finds themselves out of work or on lower wages because of low-skilled immigration, life simply doesn't seem fair." Though May spoke about the victims of 2008 and Tory austerity in the third person, the Lehman moment served as retrospective justification for a fundamental reorientation. Henceforth, she would put the power of government squarely at the service of ordinary working-class people. She pilloried uncaring bosses, tax-avoiding international companies, internet companies that refused to cooperate in the fight against terrorism, and corporate directors who took out massive dividends while knowing the company pension is about to go bust. Using language more to be expected from Putin or a Latin American demagogue, she warned, "I'm putting you on warning. This can't go on anymore." Control, restricting immigration, and equity would have priority over absolute growth. It was not a liberal vision. It implied an entirely new apparatus of regulation and control. As one critic noted, May's effort to exclude foreigners from the workforce would require putting in place a degree of government interference in the labour market that would make even the most die-hard socialist blush. Margaret Thatcher must be turning in her grave. It was a small price to pay for someone with May's background in the Home Office, what might politely be described as the protective branch of government. But it begged the following question. How far was May really willing to go in curbing the excesses of big business? It was one thing to erect barriers against foreign workers and unwanted refugees, quite another to deal with a major foreign investor. When Nissan threatened to rethink its investment in Sunderland, the muscular state was quick to invite the car company to Downing Street for talks. The government would later deny that it had promised to indemnify Nissan for the costs of a bad Brexit deal. But Nissan was an early sign that taking back control might not turn out to be the bold act of autonomy that some imagined. It might very well turn out to be a rather expensive and humiliating process of negotiation. And what about the City of London? After Brexit, could it continue to function as the hub between global finance and the Eurozone? Could it continue as the main centre for euro clearing and euro derivatives? The bankers were not about to give up without a fight. The city lobbied hard for the government to prioritise the existing passporting agreements, under which banks operating in London were de facto recognised as operating inside the Eurozone. If no such deal was forthcoming, research commissioned by the city threatened that the collapse in business with the euro area might result in losses as large as £32 to £38 billion in revenues, 65,000 to 75,000 jobs, and perhaps as much as £10 billion in tax receipts per annum. These, of course, were precisely the kinds of estimates mobilised by the Remain campaign, to little effect. What influence would they have now? In the immediate aftermath of the referendum, it seemed that Downing Street might be amenable to a compromise deal. But by January 2017, the mood had hardened. The UK would insist on the right to restrict the freedom of movement and judicial sovereignty, and this meant that London could expect no concessions from Brussels. Not only did Brexit mean Brexit, but Brexit meant hard Brexit. This was the message that May delivered in speech after speech, and also in direct talks with leading finance bosses. When asked by Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs, one of the largest corporate donors to the Remain campaign, to rank the City of London in her list of priorities, May dodged the question. The bankers realized, with incredulity, that they were no longer top of the list. The city's passporting arrangements were less important than regaining control over Polish plumbers. But who, in fact, would determine the outcome of Brexit? Over the winter of 2016 to 2017, the realization began to dawn that the freedom and control one claimed for oneself also applied to those one detached oneself from. What freedom the UK gained at what price would depend on the kind of bargain that the EU was willing to offer now that it was free of the troublesome British. The advocates of Brexit insisted that Germany and others would be forced to offer Britain a good deal on account of their export interests. Britain's gaping trade deficit would be its chief bargaining card. But this simplistic logic was a poor guide to the functioning of a complex organisation like the EU, in which an entire mesh of interests and concerns would be brought to bear on the Brexit question. With remarkable speed and with clear leadership from Berlin, the other states of the EU agreed on a tough bargaining position, which insisted that there would be no trade talks before the terms of the divorce were settled. Britain would have to agree to meet its financial obligations to the EU, running into the tens of billions of euros. There could be no access to the common market without freedom of movement. The writ of the European Court of Justice would continue to run as far as citizens of the EU were concerned. Once Britain triggered Article 50, setting Brexit in motion, there would be a 2-year clock. No deal would mean that Britain would crash out of the EU into limbo. It would even have to renegotiate its position in the World Trade Organization. As Juncker explained to May over dinner in London in May 2017, the British were kidding themselves if they imagined there was a good outcome to Brexit. Characteristically, as the true complexity and difficulty of the situation began to dawn on London, May's government reacted with drastic, crude, and contradictory threats. In her October 2016 speech to the Tory Party conference, May had linked the demand for sovereignty to a vision of national solidarity. But as the negotiating positions hardened, it became clear that there was also another option. As May put it to the EU's ambassadors in mid-January at a set-piece meeting in Lancaster House, if Britain could not get an acceptable trade deal from the EU, it would walk away without agreement. If the EU took a punitive stance, Britain would respond by abandoning the European model and setting the competitive tax rates and the policies that would attract the world's best companies and biggest investors. Britain would reconfigure itself, journalists reported, as a low-tax Singapore of the West. Days later, Chancellor Philip Hammond repeated the threat. He personally hoped that the UK would be able to remain in the mainstream of European economic and social thinking. But if we are forced to be something different, then we will have to become something different. To regain competitiveness, Britain might be forced to reconsider its economic model, and you can be sure we will do whatever we have to do. The Remain campaign had always insisted that the Brexit decision put the entire economy in play. With the threats they made as they approached negotiations with the EU in January 2017, Hammond and May effectively acknowledged the force of the Remain position. Far from taming British capitalism, the muscular state would turn the City of London and Britain's offshore position into a battering ram. This kind of bravado might help to warm the hearts of Brexiteers, but it left serious players in global business nonplussed. The City of London had not asked for Britain to abandon the mainstream of European economic and social thinking. The European mainstream suited the bankers just fine. They had had a large hand in defining it. The proposals that had worried the Tories in 2011, notably the financial transactions tax, had evaporated. There might well be challenges from the ECB or the French over euro-denominated business, but that was not a reason for leaving. It was a reason to fight one's corner. The transnational business community in London was networked in the EU at the highest level. The president of the ECB was one of their own. In the summer of 2016, when former Commission President Barroso looked around for a new job, it turned out that his idea of the European model was to join Goldman Sachs's London operation. The idea that Europe was in some way inimical to the operation of British-based global business belonged to the realm of late Thatcherite fantasy. On the other hand, the freedom of Brexit meant radical uncertainty. None of the leading American banks wanted to be preparing contingency plans to move their euro business out of London. But what was the alternative? Though London had huge attractions, its national politics had become unresponsive. The subordinate nodes in the transatlantic financial network, Paris, Dublin, Frankfurt, beckoned. And if not, perhaps the days of the transatlantic offshore dollar were numbered. The city had sensed the way the wind was blowing. Asia was the new frontier. Faced with the Brexit vote, the EU concerted its position with daunting speed. Negotiating complex treaties was what Brussels was good at. But there was no denying the shock. The EU had suffered many crises in its history. "Europe advances in disguise," Jacques Delors, the legendary father of the single market and the euro, was fond of saying. But Brexit capped a prolonged succession of setbacks that challenged this optimistic teleology. Was this, Alex Stubb, finance minister of Finland, wondered, Europe's Lehman Brothers moment? In containing Syriza, the chief worry of the Conservatives in the Eurogroup had been political contagion. Brexit revived that fear. As a spokeswoman for Moody's commented, "The downside risks to global growth stem not from the possibility of a recession in the UK, but from the possibility that developments in the UK may give rise to increased political risk elsewhere in the EU." Marine Le Pen hailed the Brexit referendum as a dazzling lesson in democracy. The right-wing nationalist Geert Wilders in the Netherlands called for a Nexit vote. Would a nationalist, europhobic wave spread from Britain, Poland, and Hungary to the rest of Europe? For almost a year after Brexit, that risk seemed all too real. And the stakes were high. Europe's economic stabilization depended on calm in the bond markets. As one analyst commented, "There is no guarantee that investors' emotions will not turn wild again if signs of political contagion from the UK into mainland Europe become more visible." The elections came thick and fast. In December 2016, a constitutional amendment in Italy was voted down, leading to the resignation of left-of-centre Prime Minister Renzi. In Austria, the presidential election was bitterly contested by the far right. In the Netherlands, Geert Wilders and his right-wing party were on the march. Theresa May announced an election in Britain with a view to securing a large Brexit majority. But the real question surrounded France. Given the electoral base she had accumulated and the Front's performance in the May 2014 European elections, there was little doubt that in the upcoming presidential election in May 2017, Marine Le Pen would make it into the final runoff. The question was who would run against her. A traditional conservative, a centrist moderniser in the form of Emmanuel Macron, or the real terror of the establishment, the left-wing Mélenchon. A Le Pen versus Mélenchon runoff was the nightmare of the markets. Whatever else divided these two, they had in common their antipathy toward Germany. In the spring of 2017, the world held its breath. The euro gyrated. European political uncertainty was the key tail risk for fund managers. The ECB's bond buying was the one major source of stability. However unlikely the scenario, if Le Pen were to break through in France, it was hard to see how even the ECB's largest programme could have avoided another sovereign debt crisis. As it turned out, the centre held. In every case, the electorate opted against the populist right wing. In France, the charismatic former minister in Hollande's government, Emmanuel Macron, taking votes from both the centre-right and the centre-left, won first the presidency and then the National Assembly elections. This put a cap on the populist spook. To their council meeting in June 2017, Europe's leaders showed up in a bullish mood. The EU had survived. It had tamed the left in Greece and Portugal. It had seen off the right-wing surge. The negotiations with Britain would be painful, but one-sided. Europe was back. But by the summer of 2017, it faced a new challenge to its identity and to its role in world affairs, a challenge that came not from inside, but from without. The challenge had announced itself a year earlier, from a golf course in Scotland on the day after the Brexit referendum. That sunny Friday morning, outside the clubhouse in Turnberry, Ayrshire, the cameras were trained on an American businessman, holding forth enthusiastically about the referendum result. "Basically, they took back their country," he declared to the sceptical Scottish audience. "Obama should never have meddled. It's not his country, it's not his part of the world, he shouldn't have done it, and I actually think that his recommendation perhaps caused it to fail." The speaker identified unreservedly with Brexit. "People want to take their country back. They want to have independence, in a sense, and you see it with Europe, all over Europe. You're going to have many other cases where people want to take their borders back, they want to take their monetary back, they want to take a lot of things back, they want to be able to have a country again. People are angry, all over the world, people. They're angry. They're angry over borders. They're angry over people coming into the country and taking over. Nobody even knows who they are. They are angry about many, many things." The speaker was inarticulate. He was not well informed. He did not seem to appreciate that his Scottish audience had voted overwhelmingly to remain. The day after the shock result, the EU certainly had other things to worry about. But what demanded attention, what made the soundbites newsworthy, was the fact that the man in question was the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party to replace Barack Obama as President of the United States. Chapter 24. Trump. On July 21st, 2016, a burly figure strode across a podium, dressed seemingly to inspire memories of Captain America, Citizen Kane, or a 1930s fascist rally. The man in the spotlight was there to deliver a speech with which he meant to change American history. It was a flaming denunciation of the Obama administration. He evoked an alarming image of America harried by terrorism, violence, and chaos. He told his audience, 180,000 illegal immigrants with criminal records were that very night roaming free, terrorizing and murdering innocent Americans. Meanwhile, lives were getting tougher. Household incomes are down more than $4,000 since the year 2000. Our manufacturing trade deficit has reached an all-time high, nearly $800 billion in a single year. The budget is no better. President Obama has doubled our national debt. Yet, what do we have to show for it? Our roads and bridges are falling apart, our airports are in third-world condition, and 43 million Americans are on food stamps. Why were things this bad? Because big business, elite media, and major donors had all conspired for decades to rig the system. Now those same forces were lined up behind his opponent. She is their puppet, and they pull the strings. At this point, the crowd reacted with chants for her to be thrown in jail. Against this elite conspiracy, the man in the spotlight promised to fight for the neglected, ignored, and abandoned, the laid-off factory workers, and the communities crushed by our horrible and unfair trade deals, the forgotten men and women of our country, people who work hard but no longer have a voice. "History is watching us," he declared, "waiting to see if we will rise to the occasion and if we will show the whole world that America is still free and independent and strong." His answer boomed around the hall. He promised one thing: to put America first. Americanism, not globalism, will be our credo. If someone had written a script as to how an economic crisis and democratic decay would lead to a nationalist backlash in the United States, this denouement might have seemed a little cartoonish. But this was no script. It was real. Or at least it was reality. The man giving the speech was the same property tycoon and TV personality who had helicoptered onto the Turnberry golf course in Scotland to revel in Brexit a month before. Donald Trump was running for election as President of the United States on the Republican ticket against Hillary Clinton. Trump's closest confidant was his daughter, Ivanka. And if you liked her convention outfit, Macy's department store was promoting her clothing line on Twitter. The following day, during a press conference in the Rose Garden, President Obama attempted to restore a sense of normality. "This idea that America is somehow on the verge of collapse, this vision of violence and chaos everywhere," the president told the press, "doesn't really jibe with the experience of most people." "I hope people the next morning walked outside and birds were chirping and the sun was out. And this afternoon, people will be watching their kids play in sports teams and go to the swimming pool, and folks are going to work and getting ready for the weekend. And in particular, I think it is important, just to be absolutely clear here, that some of the fears that were expressed throughout the week just don't jive with the facts." In July 2016, Obama's riposte seemed to many like a welcome dose of common sense. With hindsight, the president's lines about chirping birds and kids enjoying a long, hot American summer read differently. They remind us of the complacency that would cost the Democrats the election. The Clinton team did not take seriously the view of modern America summoned up by their opponent. On November 8th, Trump imposed his reality on theirs. Though Clinton ran up huge numbers in New York State and California and won the popular vote, it was Trump who gained a slender majority of the Electoral College and would become the 45th President of the United States. It was the most disorienting event experienced by the American political class in generations. The unthinkable had happened. The Democratic establishment had been confident about 2016. Admittedly, since 2008, congressional elections had not gone well, but 2012 entrenched the Democrats' belief that the presidency was theirs for the taking. Under their stewardship, America had weathered the crisis. As Americans returned to post-crisis normality, the inevitable dominance of the more modern and diverse Democratic Party would make itself felt. American society had deep problems, no doubt. The economy was not running at the speed they would have liked. But once Clinton and the latest generation of Democratic Party technocrats got back on track, there was nothing that could not be fixed. Obama's Affordable Care Act and Dodd-Frank were starters. What America needed was more of the same. Against this, what did the Republicans have to offer? Not only was Trump personally unfit for high office, but his dark vision of American crisis was out of touch with reality. As it turned out, 2012 had been misleading. Obama ran as a moderately popular incumbent, and his Republican opponent, Mitt Romney, a Mormon governor of Massachusetts with a much trumpeted track record in venture capital, could hardly have been less well-suited to harnessing popular discontent. 4 years later, Obama was out of the picture, and the Republican field was wide open. As a result, the presidential race of 2016 turned out to be more about the financial crisis of 2008 than 2012 had been. The upshot was explosive and unpredictable. The most obvious mark of the financial crisis of 2008 on the election of 2016 was the fact that Bernie